Hello, and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
I'm Romain Guy from the Android Toolkit team.
And I'm Michael Wright from the Android Framework team.
Hey, welcome.
So what is the Framework team, Michael? That sounds like a very generic name.
It is kind of a generic name. We're the team kind of at the core of the Android OS. We're responsible for things like activities, fragments, or in my case, input, display, haptics, and power manager.
That sounds like a lot of stuff.
It is a lot of stuff, yes.
Wow. So where do we begin with that? How would you stack those?
Well, so I began with input, and that's probably the biggest area. So I would start there. But my big focus over the last couple of years has been haptics and display.
All right. But what do you want to start with, Romain?
Well, I'm always tempted to start with graphics, so displays.
can we start with the tools angle?
Right. I don't want to hog the discussion. No, input sounds like a good place.
Okay. What are inputs?
Yeah, so for in my case, input is basically any user input in particular. So touchscreens, keyboards, game controllers, the buttons on the side of your phone, all of those things run through our input system. The majority of my focus has been on the touch latency because that's a hugely important factor for phones, but we kind of do it all. We do game controller specifications. We've worked with USB HID committees on this, and we've defined one for Android as well.
I see. So we have APIs.
We have APIs.
And then we have an implementation.
Yes.
And then the hard work is the implementation, I take it, to get the latency down?
Yeah, so with latency, it's all about variance. It's really easy to create a fast path that works, in the 50% case or in the average case. But latency stacks up. So if you have one slow touch, then every touch after that is slower and slower and slower.
So just so that our listeners understand, what are all the layers that the touch input has to go through? Like, why is there why is there a latency issue potentially?
Sure. The first layer is obviously the physical layer. There's a physical sensor in your phone detecting it. The latency there is around 10 to 12 milliseconds, typically on a high-end phone.
Is that true for, you're talking about the screen now? Or are you talking about like a volume button? I have to assume they're different.
Yeah.
Latencies on those.
This is particularly a screen.
Okay.
Because there's a level of like noise immunity that you have to pay attention to.
Right.
There's ambient noise in the environment that you have to kind of cancel out and look for specifically touches.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about 12 milliseconds. After that, it hits the kernel, gets read over a buffer, and then we, the Android input system, pick it up after it hits the kernel, basically. From there, we send it off. We don't apply any policy. We immediately figure out which app is being touched, and we send it straight there. So our latency overhead for the input system itself is generally under a millisecond, for touch specifically.
I see. So the OS does not, or the system UI does not sort of first get chance to take the touch and decide what to do with it?
Yeah, and this is particularly important because in the past we have had a policy layer figuring out like, sysUI want to do something with it? The only place that we do still have this style of input filter is accessibility. So when you turn accessibility modes on, like the triple tap to magnify, it does get sent and get consumed by the accessibility system. But if you turn that on, you'll see your latency jump up quite a lot. It doubles or triples very quickly.
I see.
So that's the front half of the stack. The back half of the stack is actually more on Romain's side. It's the graphics side. So once you've dispatched the application handles it. That's a variable amount. On the flip side, then you have to draw, and you have to put everything you draw into a buffer and send that to the display.
So we just switched to outputs.
Yes. So now, but when you're talking about touch latency, it is full stack. And,
yeah.
And so I work really closely with our graphics team here to make sure that the full stack touch latency is low.
And that's so that if you are touching something and grabbing it back and forth, you want this thing to follow your finger as if it was a physical device under your finger.
Exactly. If we got the front half really fast, which I think we have, it doesn't matter if the back half is extremely slow. Like it's imperceptible to users until you see it come out the display. Right?
Yeah, so it's interesting you mentioned the app, but it's not just the app. So the UI toolkit itself does some processing on input events. I mean, the most obvious one is, a tap or a scroll. And one of the things that's interesting for anybody who's used the input event API, it's a little bit noisy. I mean, I know there's a lot of filtering that happens, but for instance, to detect a scroll, a finger is fairly large. So we need to apply some kind of threshold. We need to figure out the finger has moved by a certain number of pixels, then we can detect a scroll. And those kind of things can contribute a little bit to perceived latency if you don't get them right. But at the same time, if you don't get, if your threshold is too small, then everything will jitter on screen.
I've always been curious how multi-touch works. If I start putting 10 fingers down on the screen, how it makes sense of that.
You and can actually fool it pretty easily. It's very interesting to see.
Well, I just want to point out my favorite. We have on Android, we have a set of features for like what a phone supports. So if you support 8 or more fingers on a display, it's called Jazz Hands in Android. It's one of my favorite APIs. But I mean, it's pretty straightforward. Like the sensor picks up 10 different fingers and we send them out as part of a same motion event package. And you can basically look and iterate through all of the different pointers on the full motion. So you can see at any time exactly where all those fingers are.
I remember some of the early phones with multi-touch capabilities. If you put two fingers on screen, one at the bottom, one at the top of the screen, and you move them, and at some point they were on the same horizontal line, then sometimes the display would get confused and swap the pointers, because I assume like there was a limitation of how they were tracking fingers.
Yeah, no, it is exactly a limitation of how they track fingers. We still run into that occasionally on the lower end touchscreens. It's one of my, I have a standard set of tests that I run on any touchscreen to see if they have typical issues like this. It's things like, on the same horizontal line are quite difficult. The other one I do is quick taps. So if you do two quick taps next to each other, lower end touchscreens can't tell the difference that they're actually two different fingers. So it will shoot the finger across from one tap to the next. And it will look like a really fast scroll. But there's lots of small issues in touchscreens like this that we kind of paper over with lots of tuning and tweaking.
So how does it work? Does it actually sort of sample continuously a grid of where touches are? Or does it actually know that you haven't lifted your finger and actually track it in a more physical way?
It's the first. It is basically a grid of sensors on your phone that track changes in capacitance. And then when you put your finger down, it senses basically a circle around it. And it goes, that thing looks like a finger. The reason why you have features like water immunity is water creates some of the same effects. So you're kind of have to look at the shape and the composition of the change in sensors to figure out, does this look like a finger? Or does this look like a blob of water?
I see. And so the way that tracking works is that it sort of notices that, hey, this circle was there before and it's pretty close now, probably same finger. But if you were had a really good jazz hands and really play very quickly, things could get very confusing.
Yep. It scans at 120 hertz. That's about every 8 milliseconds. So if you could, you know, move your fingers at every, like, 8 milliseconds, you could still confuse it pretty easily. It can happen.
I actually remember with our early testing system in the UI toolkit, we used to have this thing called the monkey that just generates input events, random input events. And we get crashes in the UI toolkit, and it would take us a while to figure them out. And I remember one in particular. It took me forever to understand what was going on, but basically it was something like, okay, if I touch a button here and then without lifting my finger, I can touch this other button over here in less than 2 milliseconds, you know, then a crash happens. So we fixed it, but I'm pretty sure that no human beings would be able to actually make that work.
We still see lots of those bugs come through, and they are kind of prioritized down because it's exactly that. It's like if you hit these four things at the right timing, The big area that we saw this in was actually sending key events. You could send a key event and it would be switching focus and you could just catch it between the focus changes. So it would basically happen at like inhuman times. But the monkey is really, really good at this.
Yeah, it's really fast.
kind of a funny fact of history is before I was on the tools team as an intern for a little while with Tor.
Yay.
Before that, my project was actually monkey. I worked on monkey sending input events and doing scripted input events the summer before that. So I caused a lot of these problems. Sorry.
And now you're fixing them. All right, so that was screen input. What other kinds of inputs do you work on?
Yeah, so the other big area typically for this is game controllers. Like I said, we published a game controller specification for Android. I've also worked with the USB committee for human input devices, which is basically how all input is sent to a device, whether you plug in a keyboard over USB or even a keyboard or a mouse over Bluetooth, it actually is all USB head. The trick here is that basically no game controller out there actually follows any given specification. The Sony ones look very different from the Microsoft ones, look very different from any other console out there. So we kind of wanted to publish a standard to say, this is what you should expect as an Android developer, and then we'll conform all the other things via, you know, input drivers, what have you, to make them look like this for you.
Interesting. How would a music keyboard, like a MIDI keyboard, fit into that? Does it use sort of the game spec, or is that more treated like a keyboard, or is that a third category?
It's a third category. Audio and media is kind of always the odd man out for this. They have their own team that kind of handles everything specially. So there is a MIDI API on Android actually, but it's run by the media team. And it might be a native only API these days, but just for performance reasons.
I see. Yeah, it's really important to have a low latency for music.
Yeah. And we are low latency in the input system. I think part of this is our org chart showing a little bit, just because the media team cares a lot more about MIDI and MIDI performance, whereas we need to make like gamepad performance really
well. I
think
we can make some headlines today, Roman. So do you want to say something about the media team?
Yeah.
And how they should re-implement their stuff on top of your rig?
Absolutely. It's a wonderful group of people. I'm very fortunate to work with all of them.
Not helping with the headlines.
But Tor, you touched on something actually interesting. The latency requirements between different types of input devices can be very different. So touchscreen, obviously you want things, you know, you feel like you're moving something physical. MIDI is another one where we know it matters. But I was shocked when I saw the numbers, the latency numbers for gamepads, for instance, on things like PlayStation 4 or Xbox One, and modern games who have their own latency built in. And in some modern, you know, shooters or whatever, like you get 100 milliseconds, 120 milliseconds of latency, and you can cope with that just because you're using this very different form factor for input. Like you can adapt to it. Whereas with your finger, like 120 milliseconds of latency would feel horrible.
Well, I do remember in arcades back in the day, I'm dating myself, you know, you sort of get the feel for when to push the button, even if it's not perfect. You kind of like, oh, you push half a second before, and then Mario or whatever the character would jump over the barrel.
That is not a good experience, Thor.
No, but it's what it was. Hey, it's a game. Yeah,
I remember
this is pretty
the arcades.
Cool. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and you're absolutely correct on this. Like, so like I said earlier, for the touch layer, we have no policy. SysUI can't consume it, whatever. But for keyboard presses and gamepad presses, button presses specifically, there is a policy layer so the system can intercept and say, like, do you want to send the user home? Because maybe it's the home key or what have you. So the latency is a little bit higher. The other thing I'll mention is input system is entirely in C++. Just because Java allocations can be a little unpredictable in how much time they take. So by being entirely in C++ until you hit the app, you kind of avoid that whole source of variance. But for gamepad presses and policy, that's in Java, so you actually reintroduce that because we don't care as much.
So I can remember at least one instance of when we added latency on purpose. And I don't know if it still works this way, but it was when we were working on the first touch APIs for Android, we're working on, you know, button presses. When you tap a button, you know, just tap the screen really quick, the first implementation was just changing the press state while your finger was on screen. Turns out your finger does not touch the screen for that long. So the button stays pressed for longer than your finger is actually pressing the button, and that feels a lot better. And it was really tricky to find this right amount of time where it feels, you know, good. And so you can see the press state, but it doesn't feel too slow or at too much latency. But I think that's the only place where we add latency.
I just installed a doorbell the other day, and it's the same kind of, it's a, you know, digital one with a camera, and it's the same issue where they're just used to sending a pulse. But if you have an old ringer attached to it, that doesn't work. You can't just pulse it. You have to, so you can go into the app and say, okay, actually keep the power on for 3 seconds for your old thing. All right. So that's game controllers. Did we miss any categories of inputs?
No, the other big categories are, like I said, the buttons on the side of the phone, but they're pretty straightforward. You get a volume up key, you turn the volume up.
Yeah, so it's really like a keyboard, effectively.
Yeah, and then the other one is keyboard. Keyboards are for the US, kind of uninteresting. But for the rest of the world, we don't support them very well, to be honest. Because obviously, if you get like a French keyboard, an AZERTY keyboard or something, it's not going to work out of the box. You have to go configure it through settings. It's kind of buried. It's kind of unclear.
Oh, it reminds me of the old days of MS-DOS, where you had to change your config.sys to tell it like what keyboard layout to load.
Yeah. Well, and that's exactly where we're at. Like, we just have a list of them. And we've spent a lot of time trying to align that with our default language settings and that kind of thing. But there's definitely more work to be done there. That's the only interesting area for keyboards, I think.
And with keyboards, you also have to deal with, you know, there's key repeats when you press when you keep a key press. Like, I know that's on some modern laptops, so for instance, macOS, they don't do repeat by default anymore. They bring like a pop-up menu instead to choose letters. Do we deal with that? Like,
we do deal with that. So in the input system, we have a configurable key repeat, so you could tell it, you know, how often you want it to repeat or when you want it to repeat, or you could just set a timeout to be, you know, never, and you'll never get a key repeat.
It's a dumb question before you continue with that. Are we talking about physical keyboards or
physical
software keyboards? Are they the same as far as you're concerned?
That's actually a great question. They're not the same at all. So I only work on the hardware side of keyboards. I work with hardware keyboards. There's a teammate of mine that works on the software keyboards, the input method editor.
I see. So that's where repeat would be implemented, typically. If the software keyboard wants to repeat, they would not do it at the input system level, they will just do their own.
So the repeat that we're talking about here is like if you have a physical keyboard and you hold down the F key, it's just going to print Fs continuously after a wait period.
Right. And a on-screen keyboard could do the same, but they probably would just do it in software. They wouldn't be relying on you to do it. They wouldn't be sending a key down up of it.
But even with a hardware keyboard, for instance, on macOS, if you keep the letter E pressed, I think by default now they don't repeat the key anymore. They bring a pop-up menu just like on a soft keyboard so you can choose, you know, the accents, for instance, on the E.
Yeah. And we don't do that, and we don't have an API for IMEs to do it, but it's certainly something we could open up. Like I said, we have the capability, we just kind of don't have a policy or a decision made about who controls this today. We do fight the kernel for it, though. The kernel also does it, and we have to tell it to turn off, and sometimes it doesn't turn off, and you get double repeats, and it's all sorts of confusing.
Like the new Mac laptops.
Oh, boy. Don't get me started. are there a lot of phones with keyboards still? I don't see a lot in the stores I frequent, but you know, maybe it's more popular in some other markets.
USB keyboards, Bluetooth keyboards.
Yeah, those, I guess.
Yeah, so
but at least are there any combo phones still that, like in the good old days?
I'm sure there are, but to be honest, I don't see very many of them. Yeah. We've talked a lot about...
BlackBerry, I think, made one recently or still making...
I wonder if foldables would be sort of a new introduction to this, when you can sort of have a... You know, a nice phone with a screen that's sort of not keyboard, but if you open it up, you get like your physical keyboard.
Yeah, it's almost like the foldables that we had back in 2008, 2009 that had a keyboard in them.
Yeah, exactly.
It's called the laptop tour.
Yeah. I was going to say, we've talked a lot about phones in this, but Android supports a lot of different, you know, product environments. And one of the ones that I work really closely with is the Chrome OS team to run Android apps. So we do support keyboards there as well.
Yeah, I have a Pixelbook. And so I guess Android apps there would go through the Android input system then, I guess.
Yeah, there's a bit of a weird hybrid between the
two
of
us. Yeah, that's why I'm always very confused about who's doing what.
It goes through the Chrome OS input system first, and it figures out, it should go to Android, and it sends it to us, and then we do our own processing on it. So that's where you see some of the difficulties, but we're working with them to figure out how we can kind of combine these components and make that a little bit
smoother. So that sounds like a potential challenge for the touch input latency
it is.
On Chrome OS.
So the policy manager there is Chrome OS.
Yeah, and also from my side, it's less than a millisecond. So even if they send it through us, it's very fast. But it's an additional millisecond that they think they don't need because they already know where all the windows are laid out and everything. They've already figured out who to send it to.
I see. And it's so low just because it's really good hardware or because they have a really lean input system or both?
Oh, I just mean from my side. My side is just, the software is great. Yeah.
Well, that's one of the problems with latency in general or performance that, you know, 1 millisecond isn't that much. The problem is when you start adding up many 1 millisecond.
Yeah. Death by 1,000 paper cuts.
And that's exactly what the input system looks like in a lot of places. Like we spend a lot of time pushing back on people and you get a lot of like, it's less than a millisecond. What does it matter? It's like, yeah, they add up to a lot more than a millisecond.
I think that was one of the issues with the original audio system because audio latency is also a big deal and it's very easy to add layers because you have NAS abstractions and then you just add latency as you go down and up the layers.
Yeah, and you see this in the policy layer for keyboards as well. We occasionally have to go back and start pruning people off or, you know, sending them to another thread or what have you just to move them off our stack.
Yeah, and then there are small, I hesitate to call them that, but tricks throughout the system. I remember one of the things Chet did at some point was when we get the vSync pulse, before we start, you know, drawing or doing anything in the UI toolkit, we just get all the existing queued up input events. To make sure they get processed as fast as possible and you don't wait for one more frame.
Yeah, so we do batch. So when we get to the application, we do batch them all on the application side. So every time you move your finger around, we actually save them up until you're ready to draw. And then we only give you the top event. And then you can query it for historical data, but you don't see it by default. So by default, you're only doing one motion event worth of work rather than like the two or three you might get in a single frame. In addition, we actually do something we call resampling, which is basically a little bit of... sometimes it's prediction. Sometimes it's regression, looking at backwards. So you get a touch event at exactly the same time relative to the frame boundary. So you try to do about 5 milliseconds back just so it's consistent. Because if you do anything different, you get a little bit of jitter in the signal, like the display and the touch controller actually or move relative to each other a little bit. And that looks like jitter in your motion. So your scrolls don't look smooth anymore. So we try to avoid that.
Okay, is that it for inputs? Maybe we should switch to outputs.
Sure.
All right, so displays. What can you say about displays?
I don't have a lot to say about displays.
But is there a lot to say about displays?
I think
graphics. Ramon just woke up.
Yeah, yeah. We can just let Ramon talk about graphics for a little bit. It'll be interesting. So to be clear, I'm not on the graphics side. I'm on specifically displays. This is things like backlight control, display states. So one of my big projects a couple years ago was the always on display with the system UI team. So that's actually a low power display state that we go into.
Yeah, please tell me more. I've always heard about OLED and all these things and how some are good for battery and some look better than the others. And I don't actually know my ABCs there. Can you sort of...
It's one of the reasons why so many people are like dark themes nowadays, right? It's because it saves battery, or at least so the internet says. So Michael, is it true?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I mean, we've done a bunch of studies. We look at this for years now. Without question, so you kind of have two major display technologies out there right now, which is LCD, which is a display that has a physical backlight that shines through. So it doesn't really matter the content you show because the thing that consumes power is generally the backlight. Okay. On the flip side, you have OLEDs. OLEDs are what we call emissive displays. That means the pixels that light up are the things that are emitting the light itself. So if you show a black pixel, there's no light to emit, so you have a much lower power cost. But it goes across the whole thing. Like, so it doesn't matter, just it's not just black versus everything else. It's the darker the color you show, the less power you consume on the display.
And actually, interestingly, the different primary colors, right, red, green, blue, use different amount of energy to emit.
Yeah, and this has to do with our ability to create phosphors that generate those colors. Some of our processes are less efficient than others, and there's lots and lots of research going on into to improve this.
Right. So my favorite story to tell about this was when we introduced live wallpapers, there was a big concern obviously about the battery cost of the running a live wallpaper in the background. And one of the live wallpapers I was working on was this 3D galaxy made of 15,000 particles, you know, on a black background. And I did measurements, so it was pretty cool. I don't know what we used these days, but you could hook up a device directly into the battery of the phone, and you could see the power draw in real time. And it turns out that running this on the GPU was taking a lot less power than a single static image of an aquarium, because it was mostly blue.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the power cost on a phone, the two major sources are CPU and display. And that's not GPU. That's literally just like emitting photons into your eye display.
It makes sense. If you have a flashlight, it'll drain that battery pretty quickly.
Yeah, well, I should be cautious what I say, because the camera actually consumes more power than both generally, depending on
but it's not on all the time.
But it's not on all the time. So right. If you look at like overall power consumers, it's display and CPU, but camera is very expensive, as is the flashlight in the back.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, I remember when Pokemon Go came out and a bunch of people were kind of mad at the game because, oh, my device is running hot and the battery doesn't last very long. It's like, well, you have the CPU running full speed, the GPU running full speed, the screen is on, all the sensors like GPS are on, and the camera is on to do AR stuff. Yes, it's using a lot of battery.
Yeah, there's not a lot you can do about that.
Yes.
If you want to give me like one of the big fans they have in the desktops these days, that would be great. I'd love to be able to dissipate a little bit more heat.
That would be useful.
Yeah, I like the dark theme, not for the battery usage, because I charge every day. What I like is not burning my eyes. When I'm switching, you know, when you're reading something in playbooks or whatever with a dark theme, and then you get a mail notification, you accidentally decide to look at it, and suddenly you got the white light burning your retina. That's why I want the whole phone to run in dark theme.
Yeah, I mean, I run as many apps as I can in dark theme. It's really nice.
But having not all of them is terrible, because then you have the occasional blinding experience.
Well, hopefully, you know, I know you've talked about the smarter screen brightness in the past on this podcast, but hopefully that helps solve some of it. We should be able to know that it's night and go a little bit darker than so it doesn't blind you with the white, even if that comes on.
I think the only time where I have this problem is if I run HDR content on my phone, because I believe we bump up the brightness, right, in HDR.
On Pixel 3, we actually pin to max brightness.
Okay.
Because the HDR spec specifies certain measurements, and they have to be done at the max brightness in order to hit them. So.
Right. Yeah, I mean, most HDR content these days is mastered for about 1,000 nits, which our displays can't really do yet. I mean, OLED displays get away with it because the black levels are really, really dark, so the contrast ratio works out. Mm-hmm. But still pretty bright, and definitely a lot brighter than what you would typically get under normal conditions.
Yeah, and this is definitely the trade-off for OLEDs, is the backlight goes a lot brighter on LCDs than you'll get emitting on an OLED, for sure.
Okay. I have a smartwatch here, which goes into sort of low power mode, so it can show the time. Is that sort of the same technology as the active display you talked about?
Yeah, so in fact, the system on Android that we built was originally built for watches to do this low power show the time mode, and then we adapted it for phones afterwards. In terms of actually display technology, if you have an OLED watch, yes, it's exactly the same. It's not, to be clear, it's not just showing a few pixels on a black background. There's actually a lower power display state that turns off a bunch of the hardware in the display itself. And this usually means things like you only get a 1 or 2 bit color channel, so you right. can't actually show full colors.
And right. do we lower refresh rate?
Or? We do lower refresh rate. And there's a lot of tweaking in there to make it, you know, show just enough so that it doesn't look flickery in bright light, but get power down. The fewer frames you show, the better off you are.
And how does that work? So you decide, the system decides to display some information. Mm-hmm. Is it then to sort of write that to some hardware / driver that is responsible on the phone can really sort of go into lower power mode? Or is it still, like, how inactive is, how passive is the passive mode as far as the phone is concerned?
Yeah, I mean, it's fairly passive. So most displays these days are self-refreshing. So if you give them a buffer and you don't tell them to display a new buffer, they'll just keep showing that same one.
So it's called the smart displays, right?
Yeah. Smart displays is another industry name. But basically, yeah. So what we do is SysUI gives us a buffer. Like it wakes up, you know, on the minute mark or what have you, passes that buffer over to Surface Flinger, gets rendered to the display, and then everything shuts off. The GPU shuts off, display controller shuts off, basically everything, and the panel just self-refreshes.
I remember we had discussions too about, you know, when we have this low power mode where we basically do black on white, we're thinking that maybe the rendering system inside the UI toolkit could also go into a deteriorated mode, because if we know we're going to display in black and white, we could...
What did you call it?
Deteriorated?
Deteriorated.
Yes.
Okay.
That.
All right.
So like, if we know we're not going to render colors, instead of outputting RGBA, we could output just, you know, one channel and save some bandwidth. But turns out, you know, back to what Michael said earlier, the display draws so much more battery than we would be able to save by making those optimizations that they're not worth the complexity.
Yeah, so, we talked about doing other things like, time change is fairly predictable. You know, you're going to update the time about once a minute. What if we just threw a bunch of frames together at once, batch it all up in the GPU work, and then just slowly pass those over to the display?
Yeah, that makes sense, because what you don't want to do is wake up everything.
Exactly. Well, it turns out, one, we kind of wake up everything anyways when you come out of sleep. And two, again, the GPU is not where the cost is. It's in the display. So it just wasn't worth building.
Interesting. All right. What else is there on displays? I guess we can talk about foldables.
Before that, refresh rates. Our displays, I assume, are pretty much all running at 60 hertz right now, right?
There's a few exceptions. If you go look at the Razer phone, they're an LCD that runs at 120 hertz.
Right. There's also a Sharp phone, I think, in Japan that does that.
The Sharp phone has a display that has 120 hertz as well. I highly recommend looking at them if you haven't. They're very nice.
Yeah, so what's interesting there, it goes back to what we were talking about with the input latencies. Because we can render twice as many frames, typically right now on Android, assuming that our latency is perfect, there's going to be a 16 millisecond latency built in because we draw every 16 milliseconds.
Yep.
At 120 hertz, that goes down to 8 milliseconds.
Yep.
So latency is reduced. And that's what. And I was shocked the first time I played with one of those phones. I was expecting, you know, that would take me... It would be difficult for me to tell the difference, even though, you know, I look at displays all day, but it's immediate. Once you've played with one, it's really hard to go back to a regular 60 hertz phone.
Yeah, we have the Razer phone here in the office just to see what a high refresh rate display looks like. And we took one and put it in 120 and 90 and at 60, and we kind of like did a blind test to see if people could tell a difference. And it is night and day between 60 and 90 and 120. 90 and 120 are harder to tell apart.
Yeah.
If you have a very careful eye, you can, but the difference between 60 and 90 is quite large.
Probably also easier to achieve, because I'm just remembering back in the Lollipop days when we're trying to reduce jank. And the problem with jank is if you have any one sort of computing too much, you'll miss the V-sync,
right,
and then you'll blow your budget. And that was the 16 milliseconds. If you have to go to 8...
Yeah, it's hard.
And I just worry about more jank.
So,
right?
So there are things you can do here as well, though. Like if you know you're a game and you can hit 90 or 120 hertz, you can get to a really small buffer depth, so that whenever you show your next frame, it shows on the display immediately. If you're something like UI Toolkit that maybe has a bit of variance in frames, you can actually have a larger buffer depth. So you can give yourself, say, like, I'm going to render two frames out. And then, you know, if you miss a little bit, it's okay because we're actually going to show you something two frames back. So your latency doesn't change, but you're a lot smoother now.
Interesting.
It's a trade-off.
Yeah.
I do remember playing games, I think it was the PS3 maybe, where you could tell when suddenly there was a lot of stuff happening on the screen and it would start...
Dropping frames.
Dropping, yep. Yeah, noticeably.
Yep.
No one wants that.
Well, the alternative is to do tearing, where you display multiple frames at once. But we've never done that on Android, and we will not do that.
Yeah, we have a strong policy against it. When we started doing VR, VR asked for a single buffer solution, which ended up in tearing because you're racing the scan out to the display with putting new information into the buffer. And we gave them an API, I believe, that's just specifically for them because we don't want tearing across Android. It's a really gross
VR
experience.
VR is a very special case. But VR is also a situation where the high refresh rate is pretty much mandatory. So I think they use, what, 90 hertz?
They use 90 hertz. They have a special VR-only mode. They do 90 hertz, and they also do things like they show black for part of the frame. They don't actually render a full frame all the time. So if you go into, I want to say it's developer options, but there's some way of turning this on, and you hit the, you know, show me the VR mode style display, it'll just start flickering in front of you. But when you put it up to your eyes, it actually works really well because your brain fills in that information when it covers your whole eye.
So what's the TLDR on why tearing is bad?
Ramon, do you want to take this one?
Well, you are literally seeing two frames at the same time. I mean, that's why it's called tearing, right? You're seeing part of the previous frame and part of the new frame.
But presumably it's happening very quickly, right?
It's happening very quickly, so, but you can still notice it. And actually, it's harder today, but like in the PS3 era, there were still a lot of games shipping with tearing. If you play on PC, you can disable VSync in most games, and you can also see tearing.
I remember it was very common on the Commodore Amiga.
Right. So, you know, in the context of 3D games, it's not always that bad, because chances are there's a lot of high-frequency information in front of you. Like, you see a forest, so tons of details. So very often, the tear line will disappear in that information. But with our UIs, especially with clean UIs like Material Design, if your line of text is split in half, it's extremely jarring, and it will never be in the same spot on screen every time. So you really get this, like, really, it basically looks like a bad artifact. It looks like, you know, we don't have a clean rendering. Yeah. So okay. Instead, we drop frames.
Humans are really good at noticing these, like, really small inconsistencies. So I mentioned earlier that we resample to the 5 millisecond before the frame time, because you can notice a tiny, like, a few milliseconds of jitter. You wouldn't think you'd be able to notice it, but you absolutely can.
Yeah, it turns out all that stuff is extremely complicated and takes a lot of people, a lot of work to get it right. But yeah, so the if anybody has a chance to test a high refresh rate display or device, I highly recommend you do, because, I mean, clearly they're coming and they're going to become more and more common as we go. I mean, already today on PC, you can buy 144 hertz monitors. There are some phones out there already.
Since Chet's not here, I'll just say it for him. Ow, that hurts. We don't have our pun champion here today.
You do not have to replace him.
Okay, all right. So speaking of up-and-coming displays, foldables, what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think foldables is a really interesting area. There's lots of space to explore in this still, where I don't think anyone's really figured out what exactly we can do with them, because they're so new and they're just kind of coming to the software and UX teams. But it's one of the more exciting developments I've seen across the hardware ecosystem.
There are some very interesting ideas already. I mean, I read a lot on my phone, and I don't like carrying a large phone, so I use the Pixel 3, not the XL. But I would love to be able to unfold it and get more space for reading. Just for that would be amazing.
Yeah, I agree. I guess my point is more that as we play with them and as we see more of them, the UX is coming up with more and more interesting ideas, and I'm really excited to see what the end experience ends up.
I imagine there will be a lot of challenges for the manufacturers to keep the devices thin, because we've been used to, you know, that was the new megapixels race, making the devices thinner and thinner, and I imagine just having the hinge. I mean, I know they're foldable, right? So there's no hinge, but there's something where like it bends, and you can't make that infinitely small.
No, you definitely can't. I'll recommend people go watch. If you didn't see the Samsung announcement for the folding display, they actually went through a bunch of the technology that they had to manufacture and make this possible. I highly recommend go seeing that, because it shows you all the little details that you have to get right. Because it's not just about having a display technology that folds. It's about the hinge. It's about getting the reliability up. It's about getting the glass working in place.
The touch input sensor in the display.
Yeah, I mean, it's all of them. It's every part of the stack has to support this, because you're not coming into a new market where it's okay to have like a half-baked product. Like, you're competing against the existing phones that are very, very good at what they do already.
Yeah, and you can't have dead parts of the screen near the fold and things like that. People aren't going to be happy with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you don't want to see the fold either. So if you unfold it, you don't want to have like a noticeable gap. It's not going to feel nice.
Oh, it's two screens side by side.
I mean, if we could have done that, right? Like, we could have gone, I want to say it's Microsoft that announced a two-screen, maybe it was a laptop.
Was that the Courier? I feel that like was a prototype.
Yeah.
No, I've seen Android phones back in the day that had two screens.
Yeah, they definitely have existed. But it turns out not to be a very nice experience having like a hinge or whatever in the middle of your display when you're trying to move, like, touch across. It's not good.
Yeah. All right, so we talked about inputs and outputs. What else did you say you worked on?
Power manager.
Sensors.
Sensors. I work on two sensors, to be very specific. I work on the ambient light sensor and the proc sensor, because part of the display work is, like I said, the smarter screen brightness. I'm the framework side of the implementation. So once the graciously provided by the DeepMind folks here in London, ML-derived curve, they pass that to me, and I figure out, okay, what is the brightness outside, and what is the what should the display brightness be?
But for instance, the ambient light sensor, so the ALS, So how does it work exactly? Like what kind of information does it capture about light in the environment?
It really depends on which ALS you get. There's kind of a wide variety. The most basic of them just tell you like raw photons, basically. It's an integrating sensor. So you turn it on, every photon that hits it, you generate some charge, you capture that, you look at how much charge was captured, and that tells you how bright it is. You apply gain or what have you to get more sensitive.
So how often do we read the sensor?
We sample the sensor. So we do varying integration windows. So we basically change how long we look for photons based on how much light there is. So the less light you have, the longer you want to leave it open because you'll get a more stable signal out of it.
Sounds like exactly like taking photos.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's just like it.
The smaller your aperture, the longer the shutter speed.
Yep. Yeah. No different, really. So our window ranges 100 milliseconds in a bright room to around 750 milliseconds in a dark room.
So you mean every 100 milliseconds, or So
we subscribe for an on-chain sensor, and the integration window is 100 milliseconds. We typically subscribe for the full rate. There are places where we have toned it down for power reasons, but it's not that power hungry. So we generally leave it on because it means your display is on, your CPU is on already. The additional cost is pretty small.
So you say it reads the photons, but what is the actual thing we get out of the sensor? Like, what are the numbers? What do they mean?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it really depends on what part of the sensor you're talking about here. Okay. So if you're talking about the sensor itself, like it's just an ADC that tells you kind of the charge it's captured. And then you have some manufacturer derived plus calibration to figure out exactly what that means in terms of how bright the room is. So the end result that I get is the ambient brightness of the room in nits.
Nits, okay. Yeah.
That being said, the sensor has a lot of difficulties. It's deep in a well, typically. It's got a very low field of view. So we actually take that data and then integrate over many of those integration windows with additional filters to figure out what we think the actual ambient brightness is.
Yeah, I imagine it must be a challenge for folks who design the phone, like the industrial design, because you need those sensors there, but they're not particularly pretty. So I assume the reason it's at the bottom of a well, it's partly that.
Yeah, you put it in the bottom of a well. You typically put some sort of ink over it. So that you can't see in. You really can't see it unless you put it under a particular angle of light, in which case it shines a little differently. But yeah, ID tries to hide it as best as possible.
You want to put it somewhere the user doesn't put their hand either, right? Because then it's going to get really dark really fast.
Yeah, exactly. The ALS, I said I do ALS and PROCs. Part of the reason I do PROCs is ALS and PROCs are typically packaged together. It's the same sensor, it turns out. Because PROCs, again, there's two types of PROC solutions. There's the one that integrates with ALS, which is just it sends out IR light and it looks for reflectance back.
Makes sense.
And that gets filtered out from the rest of the
from the integration.
From the integration signal, but it gets captured in its own segment to say, like, if we see it, then that means there's probably somebody nearby because we're reflecting off of a face.
So the PROC sensor is what we use to know when the phone is against your face.
Yeah, exactly. And it generally senses within a couple centimeters of the display. There's a new one that's called time of flight, which sends out individual photons and gets much better accuracy and range, but is also a much more expensive sensor. There are a few phones out there with it, but I don't believe we have one. I know we don't have one.
So that would give you the distance.
Yeah, that gives you the distance up to, I want to say, 15 or 20 centimeters. So you can do a little bit more. You have a little bit more information to play with, and it's a little bit more accurate and consistent.
Right. I remember there were some application developers who had pretty interesting usages for the proximity sensor where they were building gestures. Like you would wave your hand in front of the screen and we'll, you know, perform an action like launch your favorite app or bring the status bar down. I mean, clearly those sensors are not meant to do that.
Yeah, I to be honest, I'd be really curious to see how those end up working because the signal coming out of them is pretty raw. Like I said, for the procs, you kind of get I'm either near or I'm far. That's it. You get it.
Yeah, no, that worked pretty well. I was shocked because, knowing how they work, the sensors work, I was surprised that you could do something useful like this.
Yeah, I'll have to check them out. I've never seen anyone do this before. That's kind of cool.
And so the ALS, so we get basically the intensity of the ambient light. Do we get the color as well, or is it another case where it depends on the sensor?
It depends on the sensor. So like I said, there's different type of ALS, the most basic of which you just get the raw brightness, the intensity of the light. The nicer sensors do give you color. If you want to go deep into color theory, what color space it's in and how do the conversions is
And Roman does want to get into that.
Yeah, yeah. We'll save that for another podcast.
You asked the wrong person.
I know, I'm sorry.
Actually, I was
the audience is groaning.
I was going to say the type of ambient light sensor I want will give me a 360 degree view of what's around the phone.
So what you want is a camera. I think Essential had one of those, actually, that 360 degree camera.
I want two cameras. I want a regular 360 camera, but I also want one that gives me the diffuse light.
Oh, that'd be nice.
I need both. Yeah. One for reflections, one for lighting.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah, just sell that to the Pixel team. I'm sure they'll go for it. It can't be that expensive.
Can they make it super small?
Yeah, exactly. In a hole somehow.
Yes.
But yeah, so we do get color. We don't do much with it today. Like when you look at intensity of light, you can basically convert from the color sensor right into intensity again.
So does Pixel 3 has that capability?
It does not.
It does not, okay.
Pixel 1 and Pixel 2, if I'm remembering correctly, do. I know Pixel 1 does.
But we were not using
But we didn't use it, so we dropped it for Pixel 3.
Have you seen the Google Home Hub? You know, with the screen that shows, you can set it to show your own photos.
Yes.
And it seems to auto-sense the lighting in the room and then adjust the screen so it looks like a photo. It doesn't look like a projecting screen.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing. Is that built on similar things?
Yeah, I mean, it's just using the ALS to determine. So when I was saying you have to know the color space, you have to know what kind of light you're dealing with. But if you have an RGB sensor that's well calibrated, you can do that kind of thing.
Yeah, so it's interesting because the way we perceive white, right? If there's a yellow light in the room and you look at a white sheet of paper, you're actually perceiving yellow, but your brain like figures out that you're looking at white under yellow and you know that it's white. And one of the problems with displays is that the displays can't change their color by default, right? They will always have that blue tint. And so knowing the RGB value for the ambient light, we could actually do what happens with a sheet of paper and tint the whites to make it look like it's reflecting the ambient light instead of emitting it.
That seems to be what the Google Home Hub does. It does feel very natural.
That is exactly what it does.
Okay, yeah, I've never seen a Google Home
Hub. It's kind of eerie at first because you're so used to thinking it's going to be this annoying display, but it just sort of fades in and it becomes like as if you'd printed a photo.
Yeah, and it's basically what we're doing for Nightlight, right? Where Nightlight adapts the white point, so it removes the blue cast or what appears to be a blue cast with a more yellow.
But I think the hub looks at the actual environment you're in, whereas Nightlight just goes, we want you to not have white light.
Right,
but
what I'm getting at is just by using the input from the sensor, you could feed that into something very similar to what Nightlight does.
His point is we have the back half of this done already,
right.
And why am I taking so long to do the rest of it?
I'm not blaming you, no. Well, if we don't have the sensor in the Pixel 3, then we can't do it.
We don't have the sensor in the Pixel 3.
All right. What other sensors do you have to deal with?
Outside of the touch sensor and those two, that's kind of it for me. I'm not on the sensor side of the world. The other things I do, like I said, I do Power Manager. I don't think there's much to talk about with Power Manager.
Oh, there is. This is where
Is this the blame me for bad battery
no,
life?
No,
segment?
It's the one where I always request anyone who's adjacent to this area. I want the Nexus S behavior back. When I turn the phone off, I get that awesome CRT animation.
Oh,
I understand
that one. You can blame me for. I'm pretty sure I was the one that approved the CL to remove that.
I believe I heard that.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
is why I'm bringing it up. So can we revert that?
I'll let Jeff Brown, who used to be my manager, let you know that you liked it because I think that was his.
I think he's the one who deleted it, right?
So Matthias implemented it and actually prototyped it in After Effects.
Well, Jeff isn't that how all UX is prototyped these days?
Jeff had ported it from native code to Java. It used to be in Surface Flinger and moved to the Power Manager where it makes more sense.
I got the impression that it was deleted in some big improvement of the Power Manager, basically. Like there was some reason why we couldn't do it, but
nope.
I still like it.
It's also
a
UX decision.
We had it checked in for next to the new what we call color fade, which fades the screen out to gray before turning it off. It was checked in alongside. You could actually pick between the two of them for a really long time. It was entirely a UX decision. UX came up with a new transition off and said, we want it to be this, and that was that.
Okay, we need an Easter egg somewhere to
turn it back on.
To bring it back on. For the listeners who don't know what Tor is referring to, and so that when you turn off the screen, it would look like a CRT turning off, so everything on screen will scale down to a point in the center of the display. It will turn bright white, and it was actually a pretty cute color shift. So you could see the red, green, and blue color planes like shift, like you know, kind of.
It was
color aberration.
It was whimsical, and it made me happy. And now I'm doing it with my normal phone. It's a fade to black.
And it would look even nicer on OLEDs because you go to a true black. You don't have that weird like backlight behind the black that you would see.
We should start a petition to bring it back.
We can just sneak it in. Don't worry.
All right, but this time, if you bring it back, I want to rewrite it so that we actually simulate a electron gun firing at
sold
phosphor.
Sold. You're welcome to write it, and I will get it.
As long
in.
As we don't block it on that, I want it back soon.
Yeah.
But yeah, so what is Power Manager? What does it do? What is it important?
Yeah, so Power Manager, if you've ever heard of the concept of wake locks, Power Manager is the one that manages all of the wake locks, basically. So if you're an application, you want to keep the CPU on, or if you want to keep the screen on, or you grab a wake lock, you basically telling the system that I want this resource available to
me. And to this day, there are still many, many games out there who don't do that. So you're watching a load screen or a cutscene, and then the phone goes to sleep.
Yeah, and I should prep for people listening that are developers. If you have an app that has a window, like a game or most apps, and you want to keep the screen on, set the flag. I think it's flag keep screen on your window rather than grabbing a wake lock.
Or on
directly.
View, right? You can do it on views, I think.
Maybe it's on views, yeah. As well. Like I said, I'm the Power Manager side. They just tell me when somebody grabs it. I don't do anything arrest there. But yeah, that way, if your app goes off screen, you're not accidentally keeping the screen on all the time. Like we eliminate some of these lifecycle issues for you if you do that.
Right, because that's one of the issues with the wake locks. It's pretty easy to, if you have a bug in your own code and you don't release the wake lock, then you could be keeping the device awake.
Yep.
When it shouldn't be, really.
Yeah, so like I said, Power Manager is responsible for managing all of these. If we go into device idle, we go in through and disable all of them, disable all the ones so that the phone can actually collapse into sleep. And then the other thing we do is we kind of tell the rest of the system what we call the interactivity state. This is, do we expect users to be using the device?
Right.
Which we separated from screen state, because now that we have this weird AOD mode where the screen is on, but the device isn't supposed to actually be on, we needed to separate.
So AOD is always on display.
AOD is always on display. Sorry. Yes. Yeah. It gets even more confusing if you ask about internal names, because they conflict with other external names. It's a horrible mess. And other than that, then we tell the display what state it should be in, whether it should be on, whether it should be off, that kind of thing.
So does the Power Manager interact as well with the kernel to deal with like CPU frequencies? For instance, if you know there's going to be interactions happening, does the Power Manager help with keeping the clocks up?
Yeah, so we have this concept called, I think it was used to be touch boost. We don't call it touch boost now. It's interactivity hint. So we can send different styles of hints down to a performance manager effectively and say, you know, the user interacted, or the user interacted, and we think they're going to interact for X milliseconds longer. So if you fling a scroll list, for example, we'll tell it, we'll figure out how long we think that fling is going to last and say it might, you know, be an 8-second fling. So don't ramp clocks back down. Because when we did that originally, the finger would leave the display, the CPU clocks would go down because there's no interaction, and then you had a bunch of jank, and it was like, what happened?
I remember. Yeah. Actually, so before we introduced things like touch boost or, you know, interactivity hints, I remember making optimizations in the UI toolkit, and the result was more jank, because with the optimizations, the kernel decided to lower the clocks because we were not using as much CPU anymore. And so the workaround was to do more work.
Yeah. Audio team was seeing the same problems where they would they'd basically figure out how much work they could do in a given time slot. And they would shrink the amount of work that they had, and the clocks would drop on them, and then they would shrink that work again, and like they would eventually just keep dropping buffers because the clocks kept getting lower and lower on them.
Yeah, we recently ran into something similar working on Filament. We implemented something called dynamic resolution. Mm-hmm. So we look at how much time it takes for a frame to render, and if we see that we're taking what seems to be too long, we're going to reduce the resolution of the rendering and just, you know, scale it back when we compose it on screen. And the problem here is that you're constantly fighting with, you know, the kernel or the GPU or scheduler or whatever, that are basically trying to do the opposite of what you're trying to achieve. So you need to introduce a lot of like slopes and slack and thresholds, and it's very tricky to tune.
Yeah, this is something that we hit with games. Games basically just want a steady amount of work available to them, or a steady amount of CPU available to them. And we want the opposite, right? Like if we think we can fit you in a smaller time slice, we're going to keep giving you smaller and smaller time slices. But this really throws games off when they try to do like selective level of detail or something.
It's actually pretty impressive when you look at the low level. I was using the Qualcomm profiler, mm-hmm. and I had just an object rotating on screen. And then you can see in the profilers, the GPU clock, the curve like follows the rotation of the object. Because you know, wow. when you look at the object from the front, it's pretty wide, but from the side, it's pretty narrow.
Yeah.
And so when there's fewer pixels, like the GPU just like adapts the clocks.
If you haven't had Tim Murray on this podcast, you absolutely should. One of my favorite things when we started doing performance work for Pixel 1, the simple test that we used was literally just a ball bouncing around the screen. And if you could see jank in the ball, which you could see every single time, there was a really obvious source of jank. But it's like the most dead simple thing. But what it meant was all the clocks went down. So all the things that were taking up CPU cycles became a lot more obvious because they had took a lot longer to get that work done. Yeah, exactly. So you could see them in traces now. And it's like, oh, why is this thing, you know, holding this entire CPU for like 4 milliseconds, killing your performance?
Yeah, so I think the conclusion of so everything you work on seems to boil down to finding, like, doing fine-tuning of a lot of things, a lot of heuristics and thresholds and...
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it boils down to, I like to work on kind of on the intersection between hardware and software. This is probably the biggest for touch, and then at the end, which is the section we haven't talked about, which is haptics. But also, yeah, I care a lot about performance, which tends to be a lot of tweaking and tuning. And
so haptics are interesting too, because I also remember when we were playing with haptics in the early days of Android, you know, and basically the way the vibration
API define worked. Haptics.
So the vibrations.
Yeah, the vibrating motor in the phone.
Yeah. So you know, the vibration API is effectively like how long do you want the motor to be on, and the problem is that every phone has a slightly different motor, or it's placed in a different location in the hardware, which can greatly affect how you feel the vibrations. And I remember, for instance, you tune the vibrations to be 20 milliseconds when I tap a button, and it feels really good on your phone. And then, you know, the year after that, we work on a new phone, and suddenly you can hardly feel the vibrations. It's because that matters. You can feel, you can, and I think that's why in the IME, you can manually enter how long you want the vibrations to last when you press a key.
Yeah, which drives me nuts, because we actually did a bunch of tuning specifically for the IME virtual key click.
Right.
And then as soon as a user goes and changes that tuning, like we basically throw it all out the window and you go back to the default vibration, and people are like, why is it so bad? And it's like, well, you changed the setting 4 years ago and it's been restored to your every new device ever since. And now it just feels horrible.
So what are the challenges for haptics?
Yeah, I mean, you kind of mentioned them.
Sorry.
It's fine. it's great. One is motor placement. So on Pixel 2, is where kind of the haptics effort really, really kicked off. So if you go feel the vibration motor on Pixel 1, just by hitting the home button, and then feel it on Pixel 2 hitting the home button, the Pixel 1 vibration lasts somewhere in the ballpark of like 50 to 100 milliseconds. That's really long.
Yeah, it sounds, because I remember when I was doing some tuning of that, I remember things in the ballpark of 20 to 40.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you remember when you were doing tuning?
That was, you know, Android 1.
Okay. Because I was going to say, so like the technology has changed
since.
Oh,
I'm sure.
I want to say that I don't remember the first release we changed. But it used to be what we call an ERM motor. It's an eccentric rotating mass. So basically, it's a ball that one side is heavier than the other. So when you spin it, it like shakes.
So that's why it's only like what it's only like, because it's only like a ball. It's only like a ball that was been spun.
It's literally what it was.
Okay. A dryer with tennis shoes in it.
Yeah, yeah. And there's still phones that ship with this. It's very cheap to build one of these. It's very easy. The new technology that most high-end devices use today is what we call a linear resonant actuator, which is basically a magnet that sits in a case that has a couple of coils below it. You induce a current on the coils, it creates a magnetic field that pushes it in one direction. Then you reverse the direction of the current to push it in the opposite direction.
So you shake a magnet,
yeah, exactly. And if you do it at resonant frequency, you get like kind of maximal force, which is what you're looking for. And so it turns out Pixel 1 and Pixel 2, the physical motor, the little magnet that we're shaking, is exactly the same. There's no difference in it. It's entirely about how we're driving that magnet.
Interesting.
So in Pixel 2, we have something capable of measuring basically the position or the frequency of the magnet that's being moved. And so we can detect when we're trying to stop it exactly kind of the opposite force that we should be applying. So on Pixel 1, if you tried to do this, you would say stop, and you apply a force in the opposite direction of the way the magnet is moving. But it doesn't know when it's changed. So it just keeps applying it as if it was unchanged. So you'll see it kind of slope down and get weaker, but then it bounces around zero as that force that's trying to stop it is actually creating motion in the opposite direction now.
But if this is all software, does that mean that we were able to update Pixel once with the new algorithm, or is it?
It's not all software. So like I said, the motor is the same. There's a separate component in here that is the haptic driver.
The sensors have sensors.
Well, I don't know what I call the haptics a sensor.
Yeah, no,
but there's a sensor on the on the driver. So you're measuring what we call back EMF, which basically will tell you the frequency of the thing that's moving. And we needed that capability. Without that capability, the best you can do is you can pick, you can say like turn on for 20 milliseconds, And then you can pick how long to apply force in the opposite direction effectively. But there's not much more you can do with that. Okay. And it's all hand-tuned and hand-tweaked, which you can't really give to applications. Like, no application's going to go out there and say, like, oh, let me tune my haptics, my vibrating, specifically for Pixel 1 and no one else, right? Like, it's kind of an unreasonable request from app developers. So you need to make it work well off out of the box.
And we don't try, or we can't really do any kind of positioning of the haptics, right? So if I press a button at the top of the screen versus at the bottom of the screen, you know, at least as an app developer, the API I have is like, you know, turn on the haptics, but I could imagine that we could change the force of the vibration based on distance to give you like a different feeling, but we don't do anything like that, right?
We don't do anything like that. So like I said, the first one is how you drive the motor. The first challenge is how you drive the motor. We got that down. So now our vibration is in the ballpark of 10 to 15 milliseconds from start to stop, which is quite good. And our force is up as well. The second part is positioning, because you can't target it. You can't target where you're going to feel the vibration. So on Pixel 2, we didn't realize that this was going to be we didn't realize that we had to get our position request in as early as possible. So by the time we got to the end of the process, we said, okay, we want the motor at the bottom of the phone, where we've placed every motor on Pixel and Nexus for a long time. Pixel and Nexus for a long time, rather. And they said, yeah, sorry, there's no space down there. Can't do it. It's at the top.
And you point here like a big challenge of modern devices, because if you open one, first of all, the battery is huge.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of stuff in the phone.
Well, and basically every decision that I've ever been involved in that involves new components or different components, it's all about space inside. So when we look at haptics motors, the comparisons we're doing are things like, you know, what is the volume of this motor and what is the trade-off for battery if we put this in here?
Right, and that's another issue. Some things like assume the haptics motor and obviously speakers and microphones need a lot of space to be good, right?
Yeah, I mean, the bigger you give us, the wider bandwidth we get, so we can create different style effects. We can also get stronger effects. So if you place it at the top and it's a bigger motor, then we can kind of generate the right force at the bottom where most people hold their phones. Yeah, so the bigger we go, the more options we have, for sure. And the smaller we go, the more we kind of have to hand tweak and get things just right in order to be nice.
So does that mean we should sell a USB-C add-on, which would be a giant motor that you plug into the phone?
Yeah, that would be great. You could put it in like your back pocket, like a BTLE, so it just vibrates your whole pocket every time you hit the button.
Or that could be a battery pack, and it could just drop the battery from the phone. Right. Just have a big motor.
Yeah, I would love to have all that space back. Again, we could have the blower fan for the GPU. We could have a bigger haptics motor. It'd be wonderful.
You would just need bigger phones.
All right, what do we not ask about that you're dying to say?
I think we've covered everything.
Right. I would love to spend another hour on displays.
I could talk about displays forever.
Yeah, usually that's why every time I see Michael in London, usually we end up talking about displays quite a bit.
All right, well, thanks a lot.
All right.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks.